Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ryan Anderson, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, founder and editor of the online journal Public Discourse, and author of Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. He'll speak on the topic, The Future of Marriage. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 8, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Omar Gutierrez, the manager of the Office of Missions and Justice for the Archdiocese of Omaha.
During Pope Francis's recent visit here to the United States, which was very blessed, he mentioned a number of times, he called all of us Americans, we of this land of dreams, as he dubbed us, he called us to dialogue, And I have to confess, after thinking on the Holy Father's invitation, the first thought, because I'm a sort of pessimistic fellow, is that there aren't too many forums in our society in which we can have open, substantive conversations that often don't devolve into snapshot or easy catchphrases which lack substance, because they're not meant to shine light on the truth. They're meant only to burn and to consume and to tear people down. That's sadly the case. Nevertheless, despite my pessimism, I do believe that the university, which holds up the candlelight of educated and educational conversation, the university, especially hopefully the University of Omaha, is a place for those kinds of conversations where we can have open, reasonable dialogue, where even if we disagree, it doesn't have to be disagreeable. Right? We can have these conversations. And so to that end, I think one of the best voices for that conversation of substance and enlightenment comes from tonight's speaker. Dr. Ryan T. Anderson has his BA from Princeton University and earned his doctoral degree from the University of Notre Dame in political philosophy, where he also got his master's. With Princeton's Robert P. George and Sharif Gurgis, he is the co-author of What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense, from Encounter Books of 2012, and his new book titled Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom, from Regnery, is the first book-length response to the Supreme Court's 2015 Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage. Dr. Anderson has been cited by the Supreme Court Justices Thomas and Alito in their dissents against Obergefell because of his reasoned, philosophical, and legal articulations in favor of traditional marriage. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today. He's appeared on ABC, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, and has given talks like this all over the United States at universities. And for all these reasons, it's my distinct honor and privilege to introduce to you this evening Dr. Ryan T. Anderson.
I'll have to remember not to use any of my best lines with Omar over dinner. Last night I mentioned the how to disagree without being disagreeable line, and then it was in my introduction here tonight, so I'll have to remember that. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for having me. I was at the law school at Lincoln earlier today talking about my dissertation to the law students there, and it was a pleasure to get to talk about something other than marriage or religious freedom. A little reprieve during lunchtime, but I'm just as happy to talk about that tonight with you because I think for the foreseeable future, this is probably going to be the most contentious, most heated issue in American public life, especially with American public life intersecting with Christian communities, intersecting with the church. For better or worse, this is going to be the flashpoint. And so it's going to be vitally important that people are equipped to engage in this debate. That people are equipped to know how to talk about the issue, what's at stake, why this debate matters, and how to carry on the debate in a constructive way. I don't want to start 3 months ago with the Supreme Court's ruling. I want to start 50 years ago. 50 years ago, Daniel Patrick Moynihan issued his famous report. It was the report on the Black family. Moynihan was pointing out that at the time, births to single mothers in the general population were in the single digits, but within the African-American community, they were approaching 25%. And Moynihan said, this is going to be a problem. Something is going on that the black family is starting to fall apart, and this is going to be a disaster for that community, for those children, for those families. Moynihan was then roundly attacked and criticized and mocked for being a racist. Keep in mind that Senator Moynihan was the senator from New York State, the liberal senator from New York State. He was a liberal professor at Harvard University. He wrote this report not because he was a racist, but precisely because he wasn't. And he actually cared about African Americans. And he said, something's going on that the family structure is falling apart. And precisely because I care about them, I want to ring this alarm bell. Now, I mentioned the statistics. When he wrote this report 50 years ago, single digits births to single mothers in the general population, 25% for black children. Fast forward to today, 40% of all Americans are born to single mothers. It's 50% of Hispanics, and it's over 72% of African-American children born to single moms. The first thing to say is that gays and lesbians aren't to blame for this. Gays and lesbians aren't to blame for the rise of non-marital childbearing or the high doubling in the rates of divorce or any of the other problems that have taken place for the past 50 years. Heterosexuals are to blame for this problem. Heterosexuals who bought into a bad ideology about human sexuality and the family are to blame for these problems. Anthony Kennedy's ruling 3 months ago simply takes that bad ideology and enshrines it into our Constitution. That's the problem with redefining marriage. That's the problem with this court's most recent ruling on these marriage cases, is that it takes a 50-year tradition of bad thinking about human sexuality and of the family, and it elevates it to the level of constitutional principle. What took place in the 1960s, what took place with the sexual revolution, was the idea that consenting adults should do whatever consenting adults want to do, that love makes a family, that marriage should last as long as the love lasts. These popular slogans aren't things that gays and lesbians concocted during the past decade in the campaign to redefine marriage. These are things that liberal ideologues concocted 50 years ago and that many heterosexuals have bought into, and that's their own self-understanding of their marriage. The previous book that I co-authored with a classmate of mine at Princeton and with a professor of ours there, we opened that book by using a New York Times wedding announcement with a man and a woman. They had met each other at their children's back-to-school night. They were each married to other people at the time, but they fell in love with each other, and they said, we had to be true to ourselves. We couldn't deny our romantic feelings for one another. So they divorced their current spouses, broke up the families and the partners with whom they had created those children where they met at the back-to-school night, and then they married each other. And the New York Times was celebrating this with this wedding announcement as a sign of, you know, their devotion to each other and their devotion to themselves and their devotion to their true feelings. The reason we opened the What Is Marriage book this way is to say that many heterosexuals have a bad understanding of what marriage is. And that if you think marriage is simply about consenting adult romance, it's consenting adult romance and caregiving, where what matters most is the emotional desire and connection of the adults involved, then there's a certain logical connection with what's taken place for the past 50 years. The sexual revolution says consenting adults should do what they want to do. We get high rates of cohabitation, high rates of non-marital childbearing. We get the introduction of no-fault divorce laws. We get a more than doubling in the rate of divorce. It's this cultural redefinition of marriage that precedes the legal redefinition of marriage. Anthony Kennedy can say, oh, the male-female part of marriage doesn't matter all of that much. Only after 50 years of straight people saying the permanent part of marriage doesn't matter that much, or the exclusive part of marriage doesn't matter that much, or the monogamous part of marriage doesn't matter that much. The problem with this is that the past 50 years of American practice on marriage and the family has been a disaster for those communities where marriage has broken down. For those communities where marriage has fallen apart, those are the ones who have been hit hardest with poverty and with crime. Those are the community where government involvement has grown the most, whether it's police activity or welfare activity. Those are the communities that have the lowest rates of social mobility, the lowest rates of social capital. So if you're someone who cares about social justice and you care about limited government, if you care about the poor and you care about freedom, you have to care about a healthy marriage culture. You need to make sure that a man and a woman to commit to each other permanently and exclusively as husband and wife, so that any children that their union might produce will have both a mother and a father. The problem with Kennedy's marriage ruling is that it directly undercuts that public purpose of marriage. And since this is the question that people are always asked, I'm going to answer it first, and then I'm going to go on to some more programmatic comments about what do we do now. But the question that people are always asked is, well, how does gay marriage harm you or your marriage? Let me give you four concrete answers to that question, and then I'm going to move on to the what do we do now portion of the talk. And it's the what do we do now portion that's the main thesis of my new book, the one that responds to the court ruling. But here are the four consequences, and all four of these follow a general rubric of ideas have consequences and bad ideas have bad consequences. Because what's at stake in the Supreme Court's ruling is what the law will teach about marriage. And what we know is that the law shapes culture, our culture shapes our beliefs, and then our beliefs shape our actions. The law used to teach that marriage is a comprehensive union of sexually complementary spouses, where a man and a woman unite permanently and exclusively as husband and wife to be mother and father. The law will now teach that marriage is about consenting adult romance and caregiving of whatever size or shape the consenting adults most desire. There's no neutrality between these two visions of what marriage is. The law will either teach one or it will teach the other. And your children and your grandchildren will come to believe one or the other is the truth about marriage. And so in turn, they'll come to live out one or the other of these visions of marriage. Let me concretize this in four steps. First, in redefining marriage to make it a genderless institution, there is no institution left in our public life that upholds even the ideal that every child deserves both a mother and a father. To suggest that a child has a right to a mom and a dad will be rendered hate speech. We're already seeing this in some parts of Europe. We're seeing this in some jurisdictions within Canada. I was at the Vatican back in November. Pope Francis gave an address on the Humanum Colloquium, and he said that a child has a right to a mother and a father. There's no institution now in our public life that seeks to protect that right. There's no institution left in our public life that seeks to even uphold that right as an ideal, that it's something we should strive for and privilege within our society by giving it a distinct label, a distinct name, a distinct institution. Instead, what marriage law will now do is teach that men and women are interchangeable, that mothers and fathers are replaceable, that two moms, two dads is the same thing as a married mom and dad. And to suggest otherwise will be a form of microaggression or macroaggression. It will require a trigger warning. It'll be viewed as some form of discrimination. And if you doubt the capacity of the law to teach like this, consider that prior to the introduction of no-fault divorce laws, most marriages lasted until death did the spouses part. In the common law tradition, the grounds for divorce were the three A's of abuse, abandonment, and adultery. Your marriage was expected to be permanent. If there was a grave reason for filing for divorce, you would cite the cause. My spouse is abusing me. My spouse has abandoned me. My spouse has committed adultery. And that might be a legal justification for divorce. With the introduction of no-fault divorce laws, though, a spouse could abandon his or her partner for any reason at all. They need not even cite grounds for the divorce. That's the no-fault divorce part. They also didn't need their partner's consent. Some legal scholars refer to it as unilateral no-fault divorce because one party can initiate the divorce proceedings without cause and without consent. There's nothing like this within other aspects of contract law. There's no such thing as unilateral no-fault get-out-of-your-plumbing contract. Either you have to show that your plumber has caused harm, he's installed leaky pipes, or you need your plumber's consent, or you have to live by the contract that you signed with your plumber. The marriage contract's much weaker as a result of the introduction of no-fault divorce. What did this do? Within 20 years of the introduction of no-fault divorce, divorce rates more than doubled because it now taught that marriage need not be permanent, that marriage can be a temporary relationship, that marriage should last only as long as the love lasts, with love being understood as the romantic butterfly's sensation, not the virtue or the act of the will, choice to love someone. Instead, it was understood as an emotional sense. So here the question becomes, if you think right now we have a problem that 40% of all Americans are born to single mothers, that 50% of Hispanics and 70% of African-American children are born to single moms, how do we as a community insist that fathers are essential now that Anthony Kennedy has redefined marriage to make fathers optional? That's really the first long-term consequence of the redefinition of marriage. The second consequence is that the redefinition of marriage won't stop here, or at least there's no reason to think that the redefinition of marriage will stop here, that the logic of the redefinition of marriage will continue to dissolve marriage into any other contract. And the best way of highlighting this is simply to introduce you to three new words that liberal activists have devised to describe where they would like to see the future redefinitions go. The first is the term thruple. A thruple is a three-person couple. This was a term that the New York Magazine introduced to me about 5 years ago. We mentioned it in our first book. It's in the second book as well because it's not going away. The idea here was that if marriage is simply about consenting adult romance and caregiving, then why can't three people have a marriage? And they were profiling a Brooklyn thruple. It was three men who live with each other and they love each other. They sleep with each other. They cook meals for each other. They want to have a joint checking account. They want to file joint tax returns. They want to co-own property and co-inherit wealth should one of them pass away. If you go before the U.S. Supreme Court and you demand marriage equality for the same-sex couple, on what basis would you deny marriage equality for the same-sex thruple? Or for the opposite-sex quartet? Sexual orientation makes no difference here. Four people, Justice Alito during oral arguments asked the Solicitor General this question. He said, all right, let's assume there are two men and two women, and the foursome wants to have a marriage. And he said, and let's assume they're all lawyers, so we don't have to worry about coercion. They are all giving their full consent to this relationship. What would be the government's objection? And why would you deny the quartet their marriage equality? The lawyer had no response. And there is no response, because the way that we arrived at monogamy in Western law and Western culture is that it's one man and one woman who can unite in the conjugal act that makes them one flesh. It's that act that unites a man and a woman as one flesh that can also create new life. And every new life has one mother and one father. Marriage law was about uniting those people in a stable, permanent, exclusive relationship. But once our Supreme Court says the male-female part of marriage is irrational and arbitrary and bigoted, once it says the mothering-fathering part of marriage is outdated and irrelevant, once it says the procreative aspect of marriage is unconstitutional, what's magical about the number two? What's the principal basis for monogamy once you say sexual complementarity is irrational and unconstitutional? So that's the first term, the term thruple. And already I should mention thruples are instances of polyamory, group love. So all three people married to each other. There are already lawsuits in the federal court system suing for a constitutional right to polygamy. Polygamy are man-woman relationships with one man and multiple women, but they're each married to each other like a hub and the spokes of a bicycle wheel. So polygamy is different than polyamory because in polyamory they're all married to each other. It would be more like putting a bunch of marbles in a bowl, whereas the polygamy, it's more like the hub and the spokes. But there's already a lawsuit for this. Cambridge University Press published a book this summer saying that there's a greater constitutional legitimacy for polygamy and polyamory than there is for same-sex marriage. The next term was in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was a profile of probably the nation's most prominent gay rights activist, Dan Savage. The title of the article was Married, with Infidelities. And the thesis was, what will straight couples learn from gay couples? They will learn the virtue of the, quote, monogamish relationship. So that's the second new word I want to introduce you to. A monogamish relationship is a two-person relationship that's sexually open. And Savage was arguing that one of the things that straight couples could learn from gay couples is the virtue of the two-person relationship for your romance and caregiving, but an open relationship for your sexual desires and your sexual needs. That it's unrealistic to expect one person to fulfill you for the rest of your life when it comes to sexuality, and that gay couples have a much greater capacity for maintaining their interpersonal relationship with their partner while fulfilling their sexual desires elsewhere. So he was introducing the word monogamish and proposing this as something that will make straight marriage better. The last term was, it's now about 2 years old. It was in the Washington Post right after the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. It was written by a lawyer. It's the word wed lease. Wed lease is a play on the word wedlock. If wedlock denotes something strong, sturdy, and permanent, wed lease is meant to conjure up the image of the opposite. So just like you can lease a car or you can lease a house, you should be able to lease a spouse. The idea here is we should have temporary marriage licenses, that no-fault divorce didn't go far enough because they still have an expectation of being permanent, but then you can get out of it without citing grounds. This lawyer was saying, well, why not just have a 5-year marriage license? And then you can renew it if it's going well, but otherwise it would just automatically dissolve after 5 years. And the idea here is if marriage is just about consenting adult romance and caregiving, why does it have to be permanent? There's nothing about marriage so understood that requires a pledge of permanency. Now, whatever you might think about the theology or the morality of throuples and wed leases and monogamish relationships, simply think about the public consequences. I work at a public policy think tank in D.C., so those are the lines that I normally am thinking about. I argue that the reason we have government in the marriage business is to get a man and a woman to commit permanently and exclusively to one another so that any children that they might create will have both a mother and a father. The throuple, the wed lease, the monogamish relationship, they increase the number of sexual partners that men and women have, and then they decrease the amount of commitment that men and women make to each other. If you increase your number of sexual partners and if you decrease the amount of commitment that you make to your partners, you're increasing the odds that you create children with multiple people. You're increasing the odds of creating fragmented families and fatherless kids because you don't have that commitment to your partner so that when the child arrives, there'll be someone to take care of them. And yet all three of these new words, the monogamish relationship, the throuple, the wed lease, they all follow logically, just like night follows on day, once you get rid of sexual complementarity. Sexual complementarity is the foundation upon which monogamy, exclusivity, and permanence are built. And so once you get rid of the foundation, it's only a matter of time for the logic to work itself out. If marriage is just about consenting adult romance, consent can come in many different sizes and shapes. It need not be permanent. It need not be exclusive. It need not be monogamous. And if love equals love, why should the state privilege permanent, monogamous, exclusive love over temporary, polyamorous, open love? Why would the state be privileging one type of consensual adult relationship over another once it's lost its rationale? So that's the second consequence. Let me move on to the third consequence. We can expect to see more unborn children placed at risk because of the redefinition of marriage. And let me spell this out in two steps. The first reason is a cultural reason. Simply as a cultural matter, I've never heard someone advocate both for same-sex marriage and for the virtue of chastity. It's not that it's impossible to do this. I mean, I could think of some arguments in which you could support same-sex marriage and support chastity. But simply as a worldview and cultural matter, I've never actually heard someone say, I'm both in favor of chastity and in favor of same-sex marriage. The reason why is that the general argument, the general worldview, the general cultural values that have given us same-sex marriage is that worldview of consenting adults should do whatever they want to do. That's the worldview that gave us the rise of non-marital childbearing and the rise on the demand side for abortion, the rise for unplanned pregnancies. So if you now have enshrined into your law, which means you will further enshrine into your culture, this ideal for consenting adult, and now it's consenting teenager, consenting high schooler, that they should do whatever consenting high schoolers want to do, it's a surefire recipe for more unplanned pregnancies, many of which will be terminated, to use the euphemism. So that's part one. Part two is that there's a more specific way in which redefining marriage will place unborn children at risk, and that's many same-sex couples will desire children of their own. Think of that phrase, we want a child of our own. They want marriage equality. That's the banner under which they've sued to achieve same-sex marriage. And they're going to say, how can we acquire a child of our own? Our sexual acts simply by nature don't result in children. Well, there's technology that we can utilize. And so the gay male couple, one of them can provide the sperm. They can rent someone's womb. They can purchase someone's eggs. And they can have a surrogate mother carry their child. Flip side, if you have a lesbian couple, one of them can provide the egg, one of them can provide the womb, and they just need to purchase someone's sperm or have a sperm donor. What we know about these sorts of arrangements is that they create many more embryos than will ever be implanted. So many of those embryos will languish in cryogenic freezers somewhere. And then of the embryos that are implanted, they only want to produce one live birth. So many of those embryos, the euphemism here is selective reduction. They kill the embryos that they don't want to progress for the next 9 months. So they might harvest 2 dozen eggs. They might fertilize 12 of them. They might freeze 6 of them. They might implant the other 6. And then they might selectively reduce just to get one that actually develops to delivery. So you also have to be concerned about how redefining marriage will redefine parenthood and how redefining parenthood will redefine childhood and the creation of children. And again, just like I opened by saying heterosexuals made a mess of marriage in the family and that led to same-sex marriage, it's the same way here. IVF was not something that gays and lesbians created. The assisted reproductive technologies that we have today are things that straight people innovated with. But now that'll be further exacerbated because we've redefined what marriage is. And those technologies will now be used to create children. I'll mention a little bit later, but I'll just highlight it now. Those children will be created at the very moment of conception to be denied either a mother or a father. It's unlike other situations in which you might be missing a mom or a dad because we're fallen, we're frail, we can't always live up to our ideals. Here, it'll be by design that those children will grow up without a mom or a dad. The fourth consequence is for religious liberty, and I'm going to spend some more time on this later tonight, but the basic idea here is that what we've heard activists say for the past decade or more is that if you are against same-sex marriage, you are just like the racists who were against interracial marriage, and the law should treat you the same way that the law treats racists. That was the argument that was made. You should believe them when they say that. They weren't being hyperbolic. They weren't lying. That's what many of the activists and the elites on the political left believe. One of the reasons why they believe it is that we haven't done a good enough job actually making the case for marriage. So I'm going to close by saying we have to do a better job of defending our views, but the reason why the redefinition of marriage will lead to these religious liberty clashes is that the law will now be teaching that what Orthodox Jews and Roman Catholics and evangelical Christians and Latter-day Saints believe about marriage is discriminatory, that their understanding of marriage violates the Constitution. And it'll only be a matter of time before someone sues to shut down Catholic charity adoption agencies. That's happened in 3 states so far, and they've been forced to shut down. It'll only be a matter of time before someone challenges the accreditation of an evangelical school. That's happened at Gordon College up in Massachusetts. It'll only be a matter of time before someone says, should you still have your nonprofit tax status if you're discriminating against gays and lesbians because you believe we're created male and female, and male and female are created for each other inside of marriage. It'll only be a matter of time before someone sues a baker, a florist, or a photographer. Those things haven't yet happened in Nebraska, to the best of my knowledge, but they've happened in Arizona, they've happened in Washington State, they've happened in Oregon, they've happened in Massachusetts, they've happened in New York. It's coming to a town near you. What's most important to mention just at this moment is that none of these cases that we know of were the professionals saying we refuse to serve gays and lesbians. They had no problem baking a happy birthday cake, doing a get well soon floral bouquet. Their only objection was to the same-sex wedding. They said, I can't use my God-given gifts and talents to celebrate what I believe is a lie about God's plan for marriage. The best-known case involves a 70-year-old grandmother, Baronelle Stutzman. She's the florist from Washington State. She's had gay employees work in her flower shop. She was serving this particular gay couple for a decade, doing various flower arrangements for them. It was only when they asked for the same-sex wedding flowers that she had to say no. And then the state attorney general and the ACLU filed charges against her. And they've sued her in both her professional and her personal capacity. So at risk is not only her business, but also her home and her savings account. This is not a live and let live movement. A live and let live movement would say, if you're in favor of gay marriage, bake the cake, do the flowers, take the pictures. But if you're not in favor of gay marriage, then you don't have to do it. There's something more pernicious here in a movement that would seek to use the law to coerce other people into celebrating something that violates their beliefs. And whether it be a charity like the Catholic Adoption Agencies, whether it be a school like Gordon College, or whether it be a professional like the baker, the florist, and the photographer, it strikes me that there's no reason why the government should be penalizing them. And yet so far, we've lost more or less all of these cases, just to give you an idea of what the legal situation is. So those are the four consequences of what we can now expect. You know, the subtitle of the book is The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. That gives you a rough idea of what we can expect to see as the future on marriage and religious freedom if we do nothing. That's what would just happen if this kind of worked itself out based upon its own logic. So let me close by saying three things that we should do in response to this ruling. And this is the main argument of the new book, Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. It's three large things, and it's kind of structured in three chapters on what to do about this. And it's drawing lessons on the pro-life movement. What did they do after Roe v. Wade? I wasn't alive in the 70s, so I had to go and actually research this. But they were being told something very similar to what young people are being told today. You're on the wrong side of history. The Supreme Court has settled this issue, and your side has lost. Public opinion is against you. It was so bad at some point that it was two-thirds to one-third, two-thirds of the country supporting abortion and only one-third of the country being pro-life. They were saying demographics are against you. All of the young people are in favor of abortion. It's only the elderly that are opposed to it. A generation from now, there'll be no pro-lifers left. It'll just be the Pope and people in nursing homes who are pro-life. Public officials evolved. We forget Bill Clinton, Al Gore, Jesse Jackson, Ted Kennedy all started their political careers being pro-life, and they evolved to become pro-choice. All of the elites, the academic elite, the Hollywood elites, the political elites, were all in favor of abortion in the mid and late 70s after the 73 decision in Roe v. Wade, and pro-lifers were told, go home, you lost, it's over. That's not what ended up happening. My parents and my grandparents' generation responded to Roe, and now my generation's more pro-life than my parents' generation. And it's easy today on a college campus to be pro-life. At least comparatively, it's much easier to say that you are against what Planned Parenthood is doing than to say you're against same-sex marriage. You can get tenure being pro-life. It'll be hard for people of my generation to get tenure if they've done anything on paper defending real marriage. All of that said, it's the same thing that the pro-lifers face. There were people in the 70s who were losing academic positions because of their pro-life scholarship. There were people who weren't getting the promotions within the law firms or within government agencies. And yet they bore witness to the truth, and that's what has borne fruit of a vibrant pro-life movement in the United States. And let me suggest three things that they did that we now need to do. The first is that they rejected Roe v. Wade. They said Roe v. Wade tells a lie about the U.S. Constitution, and it tells a lie about unborn human children. That there's nothing in the actual Constitution that says there's a right to abortion. There's no such thing as these penumbras formed by emanations that protect a right to privacy that extends to the right to kill an unborn child. That is simply judges legislating from the bench. It's judicial activism. And for 42 years now, every January 22nd, several hundred thousand people travel to Washington, D.C. for some of the worst weather that the city has to offer, precisely to protest that decision. The same thing needs to happen on Obergefell. There's nothing in the actual Constitution that says marriage has to be redefined. There might be good policy arguments on both sides of this debate. So as a voter, you might say, well, I see the argument for gay marriage. I see the argument against it. Our Constitution doesn't settle that dispute. Everyone's in favor of marriage equality because we want all marriages to be treated equally. What we disagree about is what type of a relationship is a marriage. What type of a relationship is a marriage? And the U.S. Constitution, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, doesn't answer that question. And where the Constitution is silent, it's up to we, the people, to make law, not unelected judges. So just like the Constitution doesn't say anything about a right to abortion, it was simply judges inserting their policy preferences and then declaring the Constitution to support them, the same thing has happened on this marriage issue. The citizens went to the ballot box, they voted. They voted to define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. The LGBT lobby couldn't persuade a majority of Americans to vote to redefine marriage, so they decided to persuade a majority of judges. And that's how this took place in the United States, not because they won hearts and minds and convinced people on the merits that a new definition of marriage would be a good idea, but because they captured the legal elites. And by a bare majority, a 5-4 majority, they got the Supreme Court to impose this on the nation. So the first step is simply to say, Anthony Kennedy and the four liberal judges do not have the last word on what marriage is. In the same way that the Supreme Court from 1973 doesn't have the last word on unborn human life and its dignity. And if we're right about what the consequences of redefining marriage will be, if those four things that I mentioned come to fruition, if marriage continues to be dissolved, if the marital norms of monogamy, exclusivity, and permanency continue to be weakened, it will give us an opportunity to remind people that redefining marriage had these negative consequences, and we should be able to reinstate the truth about marriage into our laws. The second thing the pro-life movement did after Roe v. Wade, they protected their freedoms. There was a time in the 1970s in which liberal activists were saying that every doctor and every nurse and every hospital and every healthcare plan should be forced to perform abortion and pay for abortion. The argument was that abortion is a constitutional right. Abortion is health care just like any other health care. And so there's no reason why conscientious objectors, why religious liberty, why religious accommodations, all put in square quotes like you're seeing now, there's no reason why those people should be able to discriminate or to deny health care to women. Thankfully, the activists lost. The liberal ideologues, the liberal activists lost that debate, and the pro-lifers won. There was a variety of legal measures that protected the freedom of the Catholic nurse or the evangelical doctor or the Catholic hospital or the evangelical health insurance plan to not have to be complicit in abortion. This is what made it possible for Catholic hospitals and Catholic physicians to continue existing for the past 42 years. And it's only in recent days that this has been challenged again. First with the HHS mandate. That was the first thing in recent history that challenged what had been a consensus that you don't make pro-lifers pay for or perform abortions. The fact that the Little Sisters of the Poor are in federal court right now suing the Obama administration shows you how far we've gone from what had been a consensus in the late 70s and 80s and 90s. And just last week, the ACLU sued a system of Catholic hospitals for not performing abortions. I believe it's the Trinity system of hospitals that are now being sued by the ACLU because they don't perform abortions. So this is being relitigated again because now they don't want this norm of conscientious objectors or religious freedom, conscience rights, to be honored. It's not happenstance that these are happening at the same time, because they also don't want Catholic charities, adoption agencies, or Catholic schools, or the baker, the florist, the photographer to be free to live in accordance with his or her beliefs. So our task is the same exact task that the pro-lifers had in the 70s. It's to say, even if you're personally in favor of gay marriage, there's no reason why you should use the government to coerce someone else into violating their beliefs about marriage. The pro-lifers were successful in this because they could persuade pro-choice people why they cared about abortion. So my average classmate at Princeton was a secular, liberal, pro-choice individual. They disagreed with me about abortion, but they understood why I was pro-life. They could say, I think Ryan's wrong, but I understand why he thinks an unborn child is a person with dignity and rights and why he doesn't want to be complicit in abortion. Therefore, they weren't going to coerce me or have the government penalize me. Our challenge right now is that my average secular liberal Princeton classmate thinks that the Westboro Baptist Church speaks for all of us on the marriage issue. They don't understand why I believe what I believe about marriage, and because they don't understand it, they're much less likely to respect it or to respect my freedom to live in accordance with it. So this is what the challenge is going to be. You know, despite my best efforts, I have not been able to persuade enough of my classmates that I'm not Hitler reincarnated. If they think that the baker, the florist, the photographer is acting on the belief that God hates fags, and that's the phrase that the Westboro Baptist Church uses when it pickets funerals, they're much more likely to say, well, that's evil and we need to put a stop to that. I should clarify, the Westboro Baptist Church is a heretical organization because God hates no one. So they're engaged in formal heresy in addition to incivility when they picket these funerals. But can you blame a secular liberal who's never read the Bible, never gone to church, doesn't know any devout Christians, for thinking that we're a bunch of crazy people who are evil and dangerous if they think that's what motivates us? If they think the reason that the Catholic Church teaches what it teaches, the Catholic schools teach what they teach, the adoption agencies, the wedding professionals do what they do simply because of hatred, they're going to say, well, we have to put a stop to that. And so we have to deny the nonprofit tax status. We have to shut down the adoption agencies. We have to fine and penalize the baker, the florist, the photographer. They're less likely to think that if you and me make the argument for ourselves. This is what has been motivating the work that Sharif and Robbie and I have been doing for several years now. It's that we have to actually speak for ourselves to defend what we really believe about marriage and why, if we have any chance of being able to live in accordance with the truth. So the third thing, the third lesson to take from the pro-life movement is to bear witness to the truth. The pro-life movement wasn't just interested in beating up on the Supreme Court and then protecting its religious freedom. Those two steps were put at the service of the third step, which was to build a culture of life. And you can think of a variety of ways in which pro-lifers bore witness to the truth, whether it was crisis pregnancy centers, whether it was Women Speak for Themselves, Silent No More, Feminists for Life, a variety of new groups that had new spokespeople. So it wasn't just old, white, crotchety old men speaking against abortion. It was young, attractive women who could say, well, abortion actually is anti-feminist. All of the original feminists were pro-life. Susan B. Anthony was pro-life, and here's why. Abortion harms both women and children. Silent No More, women who had had abortions, who regretted their abortion, saying, I was sold the lie of abortion that it would solve my problems, and instead it made them worse. We're going to need to find new spokespeople on the marriage issue so that even if people disagree with us, they can at least see what it is that we believe and why. So one of the things that I do in the latter three chapters of the book. And I should mention, the first three chapters kind of talk about what marriage is and why it matters and why the Supreme Court shouldn't have redefined it. The next three chapters talk about all the religious liberty stuff, the baker, the florist, the photographer, the American founding and how the founders tried to protect religious freedom, and then why sexual orientation is not like race, because you always get the example of racism. That's the middle three chapters. The last three chapters are, what do we do now to bear witness to the truth about marriage? And let me just mention a couple of those. First is that there are new spokespeople who are speaking for the first time. Children of gay and lesbian couples who are against gay marriage, and gays and lesbians themselves who are against gay marriage. These will be some of the spokespeople who will have a greater ability of reaching audiences that I could never reach. So I think it's in the seventh chapter I mentioned Katie Faust and Heather Barwick. Both of these are now young women. They're in their mid-30s, possibly early 40s. They're young. They were raised by two mothers, and they say they loved their two mothers, but they wish they would have had a father. In the case of Heather, she was in favor of same-sex marriage because she thought it's what social justice and being on the right side of history required of her. She wanted her two moms to be able to get married. It was only when she herself got married and she saw how her husband was raising their children that she realized what she had missed out on by not having a father. She then became an outspoken critic of same-sex marriage. So here you have someone raised by two moms. She loves her two moms. She says, but they're not the same thing as a mom and a dad. And I used to support gay marriage, and I no longer do, because I now see that my children are having a benefit in having a mom and a dad that I missed out on. And then she said something that has stuck with me. She said, same-sex marriage creates an institution for missing parents. And she contrasted it with a child who's raised by a single parent, a child who's raised by divorced parents. There are no institutions that exist to promote and idealize single parenting or divorced parenting. Children who are in those situations, they're given the permission to say, mom or dad, I know you love me, but you know the missing mom or dad, I really miss them and I wish they were involved in my life. Children of divorce are allowed to say, I understand why you had to get divorced, but it's really been hard on me. And I wish you and, you know, mom and dad were still living together and I had both of you. Children of same-sex couples aren't allowed to say anything like that. I go through some of the most recent testimonies of children of gays and lesbians who said they were taken to therapists, and the therapist told the children that they were homophobic for saying that they missed out on a mom or a dad. They're like, oh, no, you have two moms and that's fine. You have two dads and that's normal. If you're thinking that you're missing out on a mom or you're missing out on a dad and that's a problem, the fault's with you for having homophobia. That's what happens here. And what's one of the things that Heather also points out is that it also incentivizes it. So think back to when I talked about the assisted reproductive technology. It's not as if someone's father went and fought in a war and was killed and now they're being raised by a single parent. It's not as if someone's parent was addicted to drugs or abusing alcohol and they had to divorce and separate for that reason. You know, human frailty, human failings, there are a variety of reasons why sometimes the ideal is impossible. But here it would actually be by design, intentionally structured. We now have an institution for missing parents. So one, it's going to be knowing these stories. Many of them have been published on the internet. Actually, I think five of the six stories that I tell in the seventh chapter were published at Public Discourse. So it was easy for me to write this chapter because I had edited all of these essays. But these are people who finally found a voice only within the past two or three years. Bobby Lopez is a gay man, bisexual man, who wrote an essay. He was raised by two women. He's bisexual himself, and he's against gay marriage. And he said he had been trying to publish his testimony for years, and it kept being rejected by all the LGBT magazines that he sent it to. And he thought as a bisexual Hispanic, he would actually be the type of voice that they would want to publish, but they didn't like his viewpoint. There's another gentleman, Doug Mainwaring, who wrote an essay titled, I'm Gay and I'm Against Gay Marriage. He lays out the reasons that he says, just because I'm attracted to other men is no reason to deny a child a mother. And he tells his own personal story with that. He was married, he came out of the closet as gay, formed a relationship with another man, realized his children were suffering because of it, reconciled with his ex-wife, at least at a platonic level, so that they could raise their kids together. Those stories, those testimonies will be important. The ultrasound has reshaped the abortion debate. We've used science to show that it's not a matter of personal faith or superstition. It's like the cold, hard facts of science are that life begins at conception. And we now have ultrasound to actually visualize this. Social science will never be as effective because social science isn't as immediate. If you've watched any of these Planned Parenthood videos, they're gruesome, and I think that graphic nature convicts people in a very immediate way. Social science is not as convicting because it's a bunch of tables with statistics. That said, I do think that over time, there will be a body of social science literature that continues to show that the best place for a mother, a best place for a child is with a married mother and father. We had 40 years of rigorous social science that showed this. There then were about 50 studies that the APA cited in its amicus brief to say there's no difference between married moms and dads and two moms or two dads. Not a single one of those studies that the APA relied on used a large, random, or representative sample. So if you use a non-representative sample, you can't draw a conclusion about the population as a whole. There have only been 8 studies to date that use large, random, representative samples, and all of them have come to the conclusion that the best place for a child is with a married mother and father, and that same-sex parents suffer from some of the same challenges that other non-biological married mother-father families face, because what the social scientists know is that biology matters, gender matters, and stability matters, and that in a same-sex parenting environment, you won't have a double biological connection with the child. At best, one parent will have a biological relationship, and the other parent will be a step-parent or an adoptive parent. You won't have gender complementarity parenting. You'll have two moms or two dads, but not both a mom and a dad. And it looks like you won't have the same type of stability. Not because gays and lesbians are somehow less stable than heterosexuals, it's just that male-male, female-female, male-female, those three types of relationships function differently. Not because of orientation, but because of gender. Social scientists know that women tend to initiate the majority of divorce proceedings. So lesbian relationships of the three types are the shortest lived. Not because there's something about homosexuality, it's that double female is an increased likelihood for short-term lived. One way of thinking about this is, how often have you heard one of your male college-aged students, children, college friends say, "Oh, I broke up with her because my emotional needs weren't being met." That's not a typical guy reason for calling off a relationship. When you have the double female relationship, there tends to be a higher threshold for emotional and romantic intimacy, and a greater likelihood that one or the other will feel dissatisfied. The double male relationship tends to be the most promiscuous. It's not because gays are more promiscuous, it's because men are more promiscuous. And if you have two men in a relationship, it tends to exacerbate the typical male tendency, which is to have multiple sexual partners. So it's not surprising that the monogamish concept came from a male. So anyway, if you put those three things together, it seems less likely that same-sex parenting relationships will have will produce as good of outcomes, have as many benefits for children, because they don't have the gender complementary parenting, the biological connection, or the stability. And I think over time, the social science will prove this. The last thing I'll say is that there was also a critical role that the church played in the pro-life movement. It's important that the pro-life movement made philosophical arguments and social science arguments and biological, embryological arguments. It's also important that there was a community of faith to actually embody and instantiate the pro-life movement. The church will also have a similar role to play on the marriage movement. And the first thing the church needs to do is simply respond to the sexual revolution as a whole. The problem in the United States isn't just same-sex marriage. The problem is marriage. And for 40 or 50 years, we've had a collapse of marriage in this country. And so the first thing the church needs to do is figure out, how do we even catechize and form the moral imaginations of our own members so that they have a Christian outlook on this rather than Hollywood's outlook? Too many of our own young people are being shaped by Hollywood rather than by Genesis or the Gospels or the theology of the body or something like that. And so we need to have an effective way of forming young people. The second thing the church needs to do is find effective ministries for people with same-sex attractions. And when I say church here, I don't just mean bishops and priests and institutionalized church. I mean every single baptized believer. If we're not in favor of same-sex marriage, what are we in favor of for people with same-sex attractions? Every human being has an innate desire for community. Every human being has a need for fellowship. If we think that people with same-sex attractions are unable to marry, what do we want for them? Because we don't want them to be isolated. We don't want them to be detached from community. How are we welcoming them into our families? Everyone needs somewhere to go on Thanksgiving for dinner. Are we encouraging our same-sex attracted friends to be parts of our households? Are we having them be big brother or big sister, aunt and uncle, godfather, godmother? Are we inviting them into our homes? This is a challenge that I think is the first in the history of the church. If you think about this, this is really the first generation in which same-sex attracted people are out speaking openly. And so here I would say, look at a group like Courage. It's the apostolate within the Catholic Church with same-sex attraction. Look at the documentary they've made, The Desire of Everlasting Hills. Look at people like Eve Tushnet and Wesley Hill, Ron Belgau, who are telling their stories about being faithful, chaste, but same-sex attracted. We need to find a voice for these people as well and find community for them. Lastly, is we have to live out the truth. I mentioned at the beginning that the legal redefinition of marriage could only take place after the cultural redefinition of marriage. Our churches will need to find a way of doing the pastoral care to help more people live faithful marriages. Pope Benedict's a world-class theologian, and he said it's not the arguments of the intellectuals that convert people, it's the lives of the saints. And so I quote that in the last chapter of the book, saying, look, I've just written this entire 200-page philosophical, social science, constitutional thing. It's not going to be the primary mechanism to convert people to agree with me. It's going to be the lives of holy families. And that Benedict himself, you know, he's done all of this great theology, but it was all at the service of making saints. And it's the lives of the saints that ultimately are the great attraction. In the same way, if for the past 50 years we would have had a 100% success rate of monogamous, exclusive, permanent marriages, highly unlikely that Anthony Kennedy would have redefined marriage. So for the long-term goal here, it's going to be what can we do to actually rebuild marriage from the ground up? Not from the law down necessarily. We have to care about both law and culture. What can we do to have more people living out the truth? Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ryan Anderson, the William E. Simon Senior Research Fellow in American Principles and Public Policy at the Heritage Foundation, founder and editor of the online journal Public Discourse, and author of Truth Overruled, The Future of Marriage and Religious Freedom. He spoke on the topic, The Future of Marriage. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 8, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.